coming up on Path to Zero.
When you have a grid that hasn't been modernized or any energy put into it, financial energy put into it for a really long time, it's very difficult. So we are focused on all aspects of this.
Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, recorded from the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit in New York City. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
In this episode, we're going to explore the forefront of sustainability and innovation with our guest, Heather Polinsky. She's the global president and executive leader at Arcadis, the Dutch engineering giant that operates in more than 70 countries. Heather is speaking here at the Reuters Global Energy Transition event in New York. Welcome to New York and welcome to the Path to Zero. Heather, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Looking forward to this conversation, but let's talk first about why you're here at Reuters. What I know you're talking here, but why are you here and what are you talking about?
Well, I'm the Resilience Global President for Arcadis, and we are solutioners, we are connectors, and we are advisors to our clients. So I'm here because many of our clients are here, and I want to be part of the conversation. I want our team to be part of the conversation so we can both share our experiences, but also learn from those that are around us. And energy transition for us, Arcadis's mission is to accelerate a planet positive future and improve quality of life for all. And the best way that we can do that is through the energy transition. So Arcadis, yes, we have sustainability goals as a company, but our impact on the world is not that great. And so we are really trying to grow our presence and our capability in energy transition, whether it's in hydrogen or it's in offshore wind or transmission, distribution, and storage solutions. We want to be part of the conversation, and we really want to understand what the biggest challenges are for our clients so we can align to solve them.
And talk to us about kind of the range of clients. At least as I would think, your clients are big corporations. They could be deeply involved in the energy transition, but they can also be cities, countries, regions. Talk about your clients and really how you help them.
Yeah, so we have both public and private clients. We have clients in the U.S. that are cities, states, counties. We work for NYSERDA here in New York. We also work for economic development corporations on the public side. We work for water utilities, which, you know, we talk a lot about water, but water has a huge energy component to it on the public side. On the private side, we have clients across the energy space, whether it's oil and gas companies or former oil and gas companies, public utilities that we work for. We also work for mining, and we're helping mining companies in decarbonizing and transitioning to lower carbon or no carbon energy sources. We work industrial manufacturing, so we design and support the build of data centers and also pharmaceutical facilities. We have the second largest architecture firm in the world. And so we build residential buildings, we build universities, or we design them and help them to be built. We also do a lot of advisory work. So it's not just the heavy engineering, but our advisory work is based on our asset knowledge and our deep technical knowledge, whether it's of water systems and how they work, the engineering behind them, whether it's about lead service lines or it's about transmission and storage and interconnectors, substations. That's the type of work we do. An example in the energy space is, and probably one of our iconic projects, is in Germany. So we are actually helping connect the wind in the North Sea to the southern part of Germany. And so that are some; those are some of the largest electrical transmission lines that need to be put in place. So we do routing and siting, design. We have construction and program management. We support supply chain. I actually got to visit one of the staging areas for the cables that have to be produced 3 years out. They start the production of the cables. Wow. So those are the kinds of things that Arcadis does. I can't touch all of it. We also do environmental remediation and trying to protect human health and the environment. Biodiversity. So we're a pretty diverse organization. We're about 36,000 people across the world.
And you didn't talk about it much, but also I think you're quite involved in adaptation now as we think about, you know, we talk a lot about the environmental transformation, and we're going to talk about something that we rarely talk about, but I think you're very involved in adaptation as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our Dutch heritage, yeah. Where the country is below sea level, has helped. We were very involved in the response to Katrina, probably some of the largest projects we did early on in the US. And just outside of the building here in New York, we are supporting the Financial District and Seaport in the climate adaptation plans. We support Boston in their climate adaptation plans, and we just launched, and you may see on my LinkedIn post a note about our support to Virginia Beach.
Oh, great. Well, let's talk about LinkedIn, because I actually did see your LinkedIn post about kind of what you're talking about here in New York, and it fascinated me because it's something we talk about that we need to do it, but we rarely talk about that we are doing, and that's grid expansion and modernization. So come talk about the key, talk about how you see us accomplishing that challenge.
Yeah, so I think the challenge, especially all around the world, is connecting the distributed energy sources to our people. And typically where we're putting those sources, whether it's offshore wind or solar, isn't exactly where the hub of the people sit. And so therefore getting the energy through the grid, getting it there in an efficient manner and not losing the energy as it travels is really an important element. And when you have a grid that hasn't been modernized or any energy put into it, financial energy put into it for a really long time, it's very difficult. So we are focused on all aspects of this. This is running new lines, it's running cables, it's also about interconnectors and substations to control the energy flow. And it's also about modernization. So, you know, we've seen quite a bit of impact from lines that aren't kept up. And it's not just the lines, but the environment that grows around the lines and the hazard that that creates. So we do vegetation management programs in addition to the heavy engineering on the high voltage lines.
You know, again, it's rarely talked about, and I follow it kind of deeply now. Do you see, I guess for many people, they talk about really the only real impactful thing we can do is to replace the wires on transmission lines. That, you know, just the cost to permit, the time to permit is just so egregious, for lack of a better word, that it might be to the point where we're going to have to physically replace the lines. Are you beginning to be in that camp for some of the existing infrastructure?
Yeah, that we actually advise our clients, both from a financial perspective and a time perspective, on what the best way is to go. And in a lot of cases, how they can use the existing approvals to be able to achieve their objectives. So not going through a full permitting process. And then what would that take? What would they need to do to be able to do that? Because we talked yesterday on the panel that I was on at the conference here about permitting being one of the most limiting factors. Projects that really only take a year to actually implement, take 4 years to get approved in some cases. So anything we can do to streamline that process. In Germany, they've actually put in regulation that is actually allowing for a streamlining of the process. It doesn't skirt the requirements, but it streamlines the number of reviews that have to occur and how those can occur so that we can get to the field and we can actually put in new lines in that situation. But there are impacts. I mean, these are long cable lines. They have a lot of energy. They have heat transmitting through them. And so the distance and the width of the path that needs to be cleared to be able to accomplish this isn't insignificant. So you do have to balance the environmental impacts, the biodiversity loss that would occur in these areas with the need for the cables.
And they can be pretty remote, very hard to access sometimes. Do you see that, I'm going to call it technology, not so much limited to just artificial intelligence, because I read about these balls they put on the wires now that very clearly measure temperature, humidity, and wind, and can dial up more power when the conditions are right and actually turn down the power when the conditions are wrong. But do you see that technology and AI could make a meaningful difference in how much wire capacity or how much electricity the current wires carry?
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation about that in the industry. And that sensor data and then being able to really make decisions based on the sensor data. And that's also on the demand side and the supply side. So you mentioned the supply side piece of it. But it's just so interesting to me that many people around the world and even in the US don't know there's parts of the United States that they actually turn off power because they're concerned about the risk associated with lines. So You know, we think about power going out only in a electrical storm, or when the line is hit by lightning or something, or a tree falls on it. But there are cyclings that occur around the U.S. where people just don't have power for a period of time. And so I think we have to use technology. And one of the other ways that we're using technology is in the design side. So we've actually standardized substation design so we can reduce the time to deliver because they're not all that unique. Yes, there are local requirements and needs, but there's an ability for us to use some standardization and automation to speed the time to deliver when we get actually to the engineering side.
Excellent. Yeah, we know, and I think millions of Californians know, because they've found themselves without power on days when they're wondering why, but the wrong dry conditions, the wrong windy conditions, and as you would say, horrible condition power lines, that they lost that. We've been very involved in quite a few microgrids to bring communities power. All right, let's talk about something else. You've mentioned, and I love talking about it, is equitable, clean energy access. And you talk about it with two other metrics around affordability, but also energy security. Tell us about the work you're doing there.
Yeah, so well, first of all, Arcadis is committed to being a diverse organization. We're not quite where we need to be as an organization, but we are committed to diversifying our population so we reflect the communities that we work in. And that, I think, is such a fundamental aspect of being able to provide equitable solutions, because who am I to decide what someone needs or how they need it or where their priorities should be? So first and foremost, that's one of the things that Arcadis is focused on. In addition to that, it's about early stakeholder engagement. It's also about supporting grant programs for organizations and parts of the country that can't afford strong consultant capability to be able to put good proposals in to actually get the funding, right, to be able to get their projects funded. Their projects are often smaller projects, not large scale projects. And so they're easily overlooked. And so whether it's grant programs, looking at the diversity of our people, early stakeholder engagement to make sure that we're supporting the communities. And I'll give an example here in New York. I mean, the housing and the buildings that are along the waterfront are not the most economically disadvantaged people. But what is important, was important, was access to the waterfront from a standpoint of human use when it's not protecting for flood. So allowing that access and ensuring that access was still there so people can run and walk and visit the waterfront area is a really important component to make it accessible to people. In these locations around the world, like Amsterdam, Belgium, and the UK, we're actually helping with the reduction of energy use and the efficiency in energy, even transitioning from natural gas, for example, in Amsterdam, where we're helping 900,000 residents, including in the social housing aspect of this. So it's important that we look at cities holistically, and we don't just look at those who can afford or have the voice, but that we support all of the communities in these areas. And for example, I mentioned the projects that we do along the coastline of New York City, but when we have public meetings, often, and I don't know if you've had this experience, there's more consultants and clients in the room than there are community members. And so making those meetings and the information more accessible, we think doing them at night on a weeknight is an accessible aspect. But honestly, if you're a single mother, you don't have the ability to go to a public meeting in the middle of the week on a weeknight. And so using social media, allowing people to gather the information on their terms, we've actually found that when we've made the information and we've turned the public meetings into virtual public meetings, we're actually getting more input. And the projects are getting better because we're getting that input and we're hearing the voices of the people who can't show up.
Yeah, because generally for me, the people who show up at the public meetings are very motivated to say no. Whatever, they're driven to be there in opposition. So it's rare to get the other side of the coin. So that's a great idea. I read, as I was studying for you, you don't have to study very long before you realize you had a childhood in the Philippines, which I found very interesting. And that's probably where you said you really began to be captured about thinking about sustainability, environmental science. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I was born in the Philippines. And then left soon after that. My father was in the military. And he had an opportunity for another tour, and I was in about 10 years old to go back to the Philippines. And we lived in Quezon City. And so in the city, we traveled to school. But we also, as part of the morale and welfare program, got the opportunity to leave the city and go and visit other parts of the Philippines. So there was a lot of bus rides through rural areas in the Philippines to go to coastal areas. And the difference between what I lived in and what I saw people living in on the side of the road as we took those trips was amazing. The sewage that was running down the side of the road, the lack of water, the lack of sanitation in all forms, was just so eye-opening to me. And I had the opportunity to go to the other side of that and scuba dive and see coral that was so vibrant that I just have it indelled in my mind. And when I came back to the United States, seeing and realizing just how different those worlds are really gave me a passion. And so I've been searching to go snorkeling for a long time to find coral like that. And I couldn't find it. And my son said to me, "Mom, you know why you can't find the coral? You need to watch this podcast or this documentary." It was called Chasing Coral. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Oh my gosh, I can't see the coral because it's not there anymore. What I remember doesn't exist." And those kinds of things just really, I can't imagine what my children's children will miss out on if we don't take action now. And so that, yeah, that's what drives me.
Yeah, great story. For me, it's a key theme that I'm really speaking to. Not only do we need to think, but we need to act, and we need to act soon, because just like interest in the bank, if you a ton of carbon saved today is infinitely better than 2 tons of carbon saved in 3 decades or whatever. So it's great story. Love that, and great image. We've talked a lot about technology and innovation. We love, you've talked some about pre-packaged, if you will, or pre-engineered substations. You've talked a lot about your work with clients. Any other innovations that you're excited to talk about that we haven't talked about?
Well, you've mentioned a couple of them. I think the use of data is so important, and being able to use that data to drive decision-making and drive behavior. So we can have all of the advancements, but if energy consumption continues or people push back on renewable energy, we're not going to achieve where we need to be. And so I think that a lot of emphasis on behavioral changes are really important for society as a whole, in one sense. So I'm excited to see some of the technological advancements, because we also know there isn't enough of a workforce to really be able, what we're talking about, $4 trillion in the U.S., right. There's not enough workforce to actually be able to execute that. So innovations have to come so that we can accomplish more with less. And I know sometimes people get a little nervous about AI. Is it going to take away our jobs? But my children, they won't know a world without that. And so I don't think we should be afraid of it. I think we should really be thinking about how do we embrace it, and how do we put ourselves in a position where we can use it in the future. And so one of the things that I think is really important is really about data science. Are we getting enough use of data science in our industry? Is the data clean enough so that we can use AI when we're ready to apply it in different ways? I think those are some of the things that are really interesting. And you look at things like hydrogen and the evolution of hydrogen. I think that's also impactful and important for us as an organization. And then the advancements in engineering and storage, I think, are really the things that we need to see continue. I just saw something about thinner solar panels, and will that create a more acceptance of it on rooftops in communities, for example? How can we continue to look at that, what's getting in our way, and then focus our innovations on those things that are getting in our way?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think one of the things that hit me in this conference, though, is are we competing more than we're cooperating as it relates to the development of technology? And does this need us to cooperate more than compete? And so I hear a lot of great discussions about ideas that companies are putting in place, investing in, but I just wonder how much of that investment is occurring that is duplicative, and would we be better served to have a little bit more cooperation on the investment?
So let's answer that. Yes, we know we would be. And in fact, that's been our message. And this is time for you to talk and not us. But we routinely talk about this wide path to a cleaner climate, which doesn't involve one or two special technologies. It involves 10 or 15. And we need to learn that corporations, countries, cities, they're not even going to choose one thing. They'll need five or six technologies to execute to the end. So for sure, we're in cooperation and not competition. But businesses are not very good at cooperating, right? And so I think we're getting there. So I'm glad you see that, because I love this conference for that very reason. It is businesses talking about practical solutions sometimes. You talked about something that you talk about workforce, and that's been a conversation here. Of course, it's very timely in the U.S. as Biden is really now talking about, you know, emphasis on green jobs and what they should be paid. But I've heard some people say it's not about retraining. It's really about finding workers with completely new skill sets. I'm not sure I've been in that camp, but I hear those two discussions. You have a strong feeling one way, or is it probably both?
I think it's both. I think it has to be both. So at Arcadis, we have launched the Energy Transition Academy, and that commitment that we've made is to upskill 2,500 employees in energy transition. So what are their current skill sets? How can we get them transitioned to understand energy systems, bring a systems approach to thinking to our energy challenges, and just have a whole workforce that really understands the challenge, how it works, and how they can contribute. We're also, as part of that academy, creating MOUs with universities so that we can have a stronger bond, so that we can bring more people into the industry, attract more people, and have them ready to hit the ground running when they graduate, as another example. I think that as it looks at the types of requisitions that we put out, I think if you look at a lot of companies, they haven't changed them. They still want an engineer. They still want a scientist. They're still looking for chemists. They're still looking for electrical engineers. And I think we need to broaden that. We have a project here in New York City where we hired an entire cadre of data scientists, specifically on urban infometrics, to help make decisions on data. And I think those are areas that we're going to see now. When I was in university, data science wasn't even a degree. And now my sons, when I talk to some of their friends about their majors, they're majoring in data science. And I think that's a great example. I think I heard at the conference earlier this week, someone say, we shouldn't be afraid of AI because there's jobs that exist that we don't even know what they are yet. Right. So I think we have to be more open in our requisitions, to not be so rigid. And, you know, we talk a lot about the cost of education, and we talk about equity, and education is just not accessible for a lot of people, higher education. But do we really need it? Are there other ways? Our UK business, and I know this is very unique to the UK, but the graduate program that we have, the mentorship programs that we have, the apprenticeship programs that we have that replace a formal university educational program. I think we really have to look at that on the technical side. We do that in a lot of our labor skill areas, but we don't do it on the technical side. And I think we should really appreciate that.
Well said. Last thing, I want to talk about hydrogen just for a moment. Y'all are deeply in hydrogen. I tend to be kind of a hydrogen skeptic, although quick to say it is part of that wide path. Can you tell us where you see successes right now with not only hydrogen, but perhaps environmentally good hydrogen?
Yeah, well, we are seeing it everywhere. We're working on projects in Belgium, the Netherlands, the U.S., Brazil, Australia, for example, related to hydrogen. A lot of it is on the siting and the construction side so far. So still a lot of details to work out. In the UK, for example, with the diesel trains, getting them electrified is very costly and environmentally impactful. So we're actually supporting in North Wales a conversion of trains to hydrogen, green hydrogen. And those are the types of things that we're really looking at, is how can we support the evaluation and the feasibility of what there is out there, and really be able to achieve those broader goals that we have. And I agree with you, there's not one solution. I don't think there's a panacea. I don't think hydrogen is it, but I do think it's part of the equation. And the siting of it, the water use of it, the electrical use of electrical load use of it. I mean, those are all complicating factors to where to put these. Then the transport is important. I think it's pretty interesting that we're using existing infrastructure right now for the transport, for example, the backbone in the Netherlands that we're involved in. So I think there's some really positive aspects to it, but we'll have to really see over time, I think.
Yeah. Great. That's exciting. I mean, I think innovation takes... So I'm going to ask one last question, then we'll go to our fun questions. You're deeply involved in mining all over the world, and I think clearly we see a need for more and more mining as we have a need for more and more nickel and copper and magnesium and lithium. Do you think we'll ever be to a point where we can actually mine in an environmentally sensitive way worldwide?
Well, I think we have to get there. We're doing way better than we did if you look back 20, 30, even 10 years ago. Many of the mining projects that we do are focused on sustainability, whether they're focused on water circularity within the mining process, whether they're focused on the geochemistry of the tailings and actually being able to pull out additional minerals from the existing waste or what was considered waste on the mines. We're looking and working with organizations to transition to using wind and solar on site. So I think we are making improvements, but it's a hole in the ground.
Hole in the ground.
Yeah. So the biodiversity aspects of that and where we choose to expand versus repair, and the offset component of it is just such an important component of it as well. But it's essential today. And so until those critical minerals aren't essential, we're going to have mining. I think we just have to try to do it in the best way possible. And that's what we want to be as part of that solution in helping our mining companies, mining clients be much more sustainable.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. All right, let's have some fun. Magic wand. Only a few rules before I hand you this magic wand. Use it one time for one thing in the next year that, in your opinion, would have the biggest impact on climate change. How would you use it?
Yeah, I would provide support to marginalized communities around the world to be able to apply for all the grant money that's out there and to be able to encourage investment in those areas. The fact that there are so many people without water and electricity, not just around the world, but in the U.S., it's appalling. You don't think about that. You think about third world countries and you say, oh, okay, I guess I can see that. There are places in the U.S. that don't have clean water. They don't have sanitation. There are people living like that. And not that one country is more important than the other, but if I had a magic wand, I would make sure that people had water and energy. How do you grow and thrive in life without those basic needs? How do you study and learn when the sun goes down if you don't have electricity? So it's probably a little bit of a world peace kind of answer, but I think for me, that's what I would ask for, is that people had access to clean water, sanitation, and electricity.
Great use of the wand, and doesn't seem like it well, let me put it in a positive way. It should be achievable. It should be achievable soon. Great use of your wand. All right, you live outside of Baltimore. We're here in New York. I know you're a good East Coaster, went to college south of all that. We'd love to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of the time and expertise that you've spent with us today. Where would we plant that tree?
I might not be saying it right, but I think Croatan?
Croatan in North Carolina.
In North Carolina, yeah. That's what I think, because it's one of the few national forests that are actually on the coast. And I think with sea level rise and the discussion that we're having here from A Path to Zero, protecting those forests is important. And my family and I, one of the favorite vacations, even though we've traveled in a lot of places around the world, is going to the shore of North Carolina.
Well, Croatan, North Carolina, home of an endangered red wolf, I think, maybe a rare species of alligator that lives somewhere near there. So I think we can make that happen. So that's a great place. Anything else we haven't talked about that you want to mention?
Yeah, well, I appreciate the conversation. Thank you for driving the conversation. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really important is to think about the next generation and how we bring them into the conversation. So I don't know how many podcast attendees you've had from the younger generation, people in university, coming out of university, but I think it would be a great opportunity to hear their perspective.
That's great. Heather, thank you so much for being with us. I hope you have a good rest of the week in New York, and thanks for being with us on Path to Zero.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.